Well, Dan, I'm going to start with you. Why should we plant churches?
Why should we plant churches? Let me give you some context. I'm a little more reflective this week. Spent the last 2 weeks with my daughter at the edge of brain damage, having fallen down some stairs and fracturing her skull on marble stairs at Jarvis Collegiate. So I'm not in my usual visionary mindset, but I do want to say that I think we need to plant churches because, well, I'll give you a bunch. First of all, it's biblical. Paul planted churches all over the place. Secondly, the evangelistic need. Jesus said in Luke 19 that the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost, and the call of the church is to seek and save the lost. And it is the case at Grace Toronto, it's the case at every church that I've been to, that the older a church gets, there's a certain waning of its evangelistic zeal that just seems to happen for a variety of sometimes good and necessary reasons, such that I've even seen in Grace Toronto in the 6 years that we've been there, a bit of the evangelistic zeal is now dimming as all these discipleship needs arise and stare us in the face. And those are good needs. Those are important needs. But the need for the lost to hear the gospel, to me, is the primary reason to plant, contagious evangelistic churches. And so for me, the Great Commission is my fundamental answer.
Habib, if you if somebody came up to you, you tell them what you do, I'm a church planter, and they asked you that question, why plant a church? What would your response be?
Very similar to what Dan said, but I would just say as well that you can't talk about the Great Commission without talking about the church, because I think we have failed miserably in many, many cases where, you know, there's a disconnect between the church and mission and evangelism, where the church now is content just to give money to a parachurch or to a bunch of people going on a mission trip. And there's that disconnect. But when you read the Great Commission, for example, go and make disciples. Well, that doesn't stop at just making the disciples. I mean, you know, teach them all that I've commanded you, and that takes time, and that takes, and that also means Hebrews 10, not forsaking the assembling together. So part of the Great Commission, is actually making sure that these new converts now also gather together as informed this body of Christ. So any discussion of evangelism will lead inevitably to planting a church. And I think we made the mistake in separating the two, and that's that, you know, and we can get into the rise of short mission trips and what I mean, as good as they are, sometimes there's also I think a negative aspect, perhaps creating more of a disconnect between the Great Commission as well as church planting.
So you're in Markham. I could foresee someone coming to you and saying, Habib, there's plenty of churches in Markham. Why do we need another church in Markham?
The fact that we have many buildings, church buildings, it doesn't mean that there's a church in Markham. So there's a hunger for body of Christ that holds a high view of God and high view of Scripture, and only then we have a proper view of man, and just to lay that foundation that is on sound biblical doctrine and principles, and that is lacking, unfortunately, in many ways, and so there is a great need to have that in Markham.
I agree with you, as if that matters. Dan, do you think that church planting, by the way, I'm going to ask if you have questions as well. I'm just going to get us going here a bit. Do you think church planting is a mandate for every local church? Should every local church be seeking to plant churches?
Yeah. I really have to wrestle with that one. Maybe. A good Canadian answer. The need for church planting is great, but given some of the questions that I'm sure are going to be asked, there's a lot of churches right now that would absolutely want to disqualify and ban from reproducing themselves, including probably three times a week my own church. So as I reflected back on the state of the church, I think maybe as a goal that would be good. Every solid doctrines of grace, you know, healthy church should consider doing it. Let me put some parameters on that thing. I think church planting is a bit of a fad right now, and I think we need to be a little bit careful to take it off the trendy pedestal that it's on. Church planting is really hard. I don't think most of us know the cost of what it takes to plant a church. The cost is either borne by the mother church providing all the necessary ingredients to make it an easier role for the planter, which is the model I think you guys do well, or the cost is borne by the planter coming in without that support, which it was the model that I followed. But it's a tremendous cost, and you really need to look that one in the eye, and you really need to understand it. So I do believe the churches should be far more focused on it, but they should really understand what it will take, and we'll probably talk a little bit more about that. So every congregation, I'm not so sure. I think some churches are called to be church planting churches and resource churches, and they have been given the gifts to understand what that takes, develop what that takes, send it out with the proper support. Some churches, there's a lot of specific gifting that church would need to have to do it well, in my opinion, in Canada at this point. So I don't think a lot of churches have that, so I would be very hesitant to ask every church to go plant a church, because what would happen would be you'd have a lot of really bad church plants out there that would cause a lot of pain to a lot of people, and I don't think the body needs that kind of wounding. So let me qualify my remarks that way.
Would you add anything to that, Habib?
I think readiness is definitely an issue to keep in mind, but I do believe it is something a church should strive for. And again, I go back to the Great Commission. You can't have a discussion about the Great Commission without eventually leading to church plant. And you see the model in the New Testament the same way, where the church in Jerusalem heard about the conversion in Antioch by those who were scattered because of the persecution of Stephen, and they sent Barnabas, you know, quickly to go and strengthen the believers. And he found Saul, and they went Paul, and then they went together, and they stayed for extended period of time to really plant that church really and get it off its feet. And then the church in Antioch sends Paul and Barnabas out as well, and it's a church plant. So you have this church plant sending, missionaries to do that. So.
But I wouldn't want the Church of Galatia to plant churches. Not until they straighten themselves out.
That's a good point. What determines success in your mind? Is it better to have a large congregation or to plant many smaller congregations? I'll frame the question that way.
I look at Acts 13 as a good model, where you find the chapter begins with a group of leaders, these godly men who, you know, and as they ministered, as they are working in the church, they prayerfully sent Paul and Barnabas out. And the reason I say this is because you must have this plurality of leaders who together would definitely help evaluate the work and together determine where we're at and how we're doing and whether we need to change course or not. And so it is absolutely essential. You know, this is not a lone ranger kind of thing. So you definitely need to have behind you godly elders who are really holding you accountable, as well as providing, guidance and biblical, godly evaluation to where we're at. And then, in each case, then the evaluation is made and determination whether we need to change direction or not.
I don't know. It seems to be contextually different. I mean, if you look at early church history, Antioch seemed to become a sending ground. Yeah, even though Jerusalem sent to Antioch, then Antioch sent out Paul and Barnabas, and they planted a ton of churches, obviously, as in their apostolic role. Some of those churches were larger and some were smaller. As we know in church history, the church at Rome became a fabulous sending ground, planting way more churches. And historically, my understanding is the reason the Bishop of Rome became preeminent was because of the Church of Rome's success at being the church planting center for most of Europe in the first and second and third centuries. So you seem to see both models. I mean, for Paul, it was every major city at least was going to have a church, and how it grew. So, yeah, great answer. Eh? I'm really decisive.
You're very Canadian. let me throw it out this way. Matthew, have you got a microphone or somebody running up? Julian's got a mic just so we can hear your question. If somebody has a question out here. No questions out there? All right, I'll come right back after you guys.
Daryl.
Oh, Daryl. Yeah, thanks, Daryl.
There seem to be accidental church planters, so people who probably never dreamt of becoming a church planter, but in God's providence end up doing so. So could you talk about maybe the fork in the roads between church planting and church renewal and kind of normal pastoral ministry? I once asked Ed Stetzer about that, and he said, I've never heard a dumb question before, but that comes pretty close. He says, like, I disagree with him. He says, basically, you're a church planter or you're a church renewal guy, and never the twain shall mix. Two totally different people. And I just see there are actually people that have done both quite effectively. So help me out.
I was going to quip, who am I to disagree with Ed Stetzer, but I won't. I will disagree with him. I think it's a good question. I'm both a church planter and a church renewal guy at the same time, so this is kind of a thing I've had to think about a little bit. The difference between a church planter and a church renewal guy, generally speaking, is the amount of patience they have to effect change. A church planter gets to effect change immediately and do it their own way. And so patience is not nearly as big a virtue in the church planter as it is in the church renewal person who comes into a church with an established tradition. The greater the tradition and the stronger the tradition that they need to change, the more patience it's going to require. So I really do see them as similar roles, renewing a church and starting a new renewed church in a new way with slightly different gifts. You have the same vision, but you have to go about it very differently. So, yeah, I mean, it's a little bit like an oil tanker. You have to choose. If you're going to stop it, you've got to start the brakes 6 miles, whereas, a speedboat, a little quicker. And so there are different, but you need to have a lot of the same gifts. You need to be willing to change. You need to be able to confront existing patterns of stratified, ossified thinking and be able to challenge people in the gospel to change those things. You need to be willing to take a lot of criticism. You need to be willing to renew people in the vision. You need to start at a vision base before you get to strategy. People need to buy in, align on a conceptual, philosophical vision way before they can move forward. The difference between a church planter is that he's always talking to people, and they don't come in unless they have it. You already have them, and so you have to do the same role. But so you have to have the same convictions. You have to have the same courage. You have to have the same thick skin. You have to have the same perseverance. And you have to be willing to roll the dice and trust the Lord that change will happen. But there are different kinds. So I see some commonalities, but patience is, to me, the grand canyon of difference. It takes so much longer.
On the issue of patience, there's a good model, and would be Capitol Hill Baptist Church. In his book, Mark Dever, The Deliberate Church, he mentions the three P's: prayer, patience, and perseverance. And he really addresses some of those things that Dan mentioned in terms of, you know, being willing to, you know, be you know, able to confront people lovingly, but at the same time with patience and do what you need to do. So.
I'm going to answer, too, even though I'm not supposed to answer. But I liked your question, too, Daryl, not just because you're my friend and you let us use your building for free. but those things helped. But I'm just I'm just thinking, you know, Habib, you were in a situation in another church, part of a pastoral team there, but for doctrinal reasons and primarily that, it became evident that that group of people needed to move out. So it wasn't that you were this, I'm going to plant a church guy. I would say there was a certain, I don't know if reluctance is the right word, but it wasn't like you were dying to go out and plant a church. You were trying to make that work for 13 years. I was in a similar situation in a church for much shorter time, 2.5 years, and was very content to be there. I wasn't eager. In fact, I took a church planning course in seminary and shook the professor's hand at the end and said, thanks, you showed me I'm not a church planner. I'm really glad that I didn't waste my life planning a church, trying to. So, I mean, just as I'm pondering your question, I think, you know, so much of it really depends where the Lord puts you, right? And the gifting that you have. But there's areas where I think as a man, I would not have qualified under some evaluations to be a church planter.
That's me.
That's you too. I know. And yet the Lord put me in that situation. But then that forced the gospel to have to change things about me and about my family, and which were great things for which we're very thankful for. And you look back and think, never would have planned it, so thankful the Lord did it that way. So I do wonder if that, which leads me to the question, like, you guys do a great job of evaluating the man. I'm always curious when we talk privately about sort of that stuff, that process you go through and the Redeemer stuff and all of that. And you'll come to conclusions of saying, you know, this guy is not a church planner guy. And why it intrigues me is because I'll look at some guys and think, that guy should not plant a church. And for me, it's more intuitive and probably just arrogance. but what process, in that process, what are the, you know, you're identifying and saying it should be a certain kind of guy. And maybe that guy doesn't even see it in himself. Right? Like, I don't know. Just talk about that process, and I'll ask another question. That wasn't really a question as much as
no.
A statement.
By the way, you'd have passed any assessment that I know of.
Yeah, right.
You're the cockiest.
Just kidding.
The other thing to say is you're not. You think you're intuiting it, but you're not. You're seasoned enough to know what to look for. You've seen enough that you just size it up a little more quickly. The assessors in our denomination, they play, what's that, name that tune? I can figure out whether this guy's qualified in, you know, three notes or whatever. Yeah, so they got it down to 30 minutes. The best two guys in our denomination, within the first 30 minutes of assessing, they put it down, and they're pretty well 90% plus sure, because they're a bit like you. They've seen enough, and they know enough. You kind of, after a while.
Okay, let me interject one of my questions then. But if... You know, if a fellow comes to that conclusion in 30 minutes, what if he's wrong? What if it's that guy actually can change in certain ways?
In 30 minutes, you can tell the obvious yeses and the obvious noes. There's the gray area of people that take more than 30, and so I got to take these guys off the pedestal and be honest. A church planner, there's something a little more apostolic about church planning. You've got to have the wiring by God to be, the gifting by God to be able to not have a job description for a while, have most of your day when you're starting a church, you don't have anyone, depends on the type of church plant. Julian's planning one where he has an existing core of people already. I had nobody. So, it depends. We even qualify. You could be qualified to plant a church from a mother church with a core group. You could be qualified to plant a church with a core group that already exists. You could be qualified to just parachute into a completely new city and figure it out. And there's those three levels of church planning that we look at. And there are different ways of looking at it. But, yes, church planning is not just being a pastor. You've got to have a certain ability to deal with lack of structure, a certain ability to start things, a certain ability to attract people, network well. In our denomination, if you're not a pretty capable evangelist, they won't let you church plant. You've got to be able to share the gospel naturally and easily and clearly, because we don't want to plant just teaching church plants. Our denomination is good at teaching churches, but we know that that's not the direction. As North America gets more secular, if you don't have evangelistic abilities, maybe not the gift of evangelism, but at least a very capable evangelist, and you're going to create an evangelistic ethos, then you're usually not going to be qualified. Yeah.
Good. If that hasn't stirred questions, I don't know what will. So, Ian's over there. TV, I'm hearing a little bit of feedback here. I don't know if you guys are.
Dan, and one for Paul, if I'm allowed to ask the interview guy. Dan, I'm just wondering if you could describe the PCA's role in your church plant, right from training to early stages to present day. How have they been involved? How have they been helpful? What have they done? And Paul, if you're willing, you've done three church plants. I see them very differently. One's kind of an adoption, one's kind of a pioneer, and one's kind of a hive off. And if you'd be willing to correct my categories and also share ways that you've supported the church, the different kinds of church plants under you.
Our denomination, it starts with, if you feel called or someone thinks you're called, you go to something called an assessment. It's 4 days, 4 or 5 days of intense assessing with all kinds of personality, a 360-degree evaluation by people who've already seen you in ministry, personality testing. You see a Christian counselor who is trained just to talk about your marriage dynamics, because that's a huge part of church planning if you're married. And then you go through 4 days of assessing your ability to preach, share the gospel, work in teams, share the vision, lead managerial situations, discern difficult pastoral shepherding situations, talk about it in teams, move people toward a goal. Probably one of the more intense scrubs of your life you will ever get. Considered right now, anyways, PCA's assessment, because it's probably one of the top two assessments in all of church planning, at least in the English-speaking world. So it's very thorough. That's the first step. Then the second step is you get a coach who coaches you in your church planning. Then you have the opportunity to raise funds through the hold of the PCA, but they decentralize that. They don't give you central funding like they maybe, I don't know, other denominations might, but they allow you to raise funds with their imprimatur, and they sometimes help you connect you with that. And we got connected to Redeemer in New York as a church planting funding thing. They decided to help fund us, but they asked us to help to use some of the funds they gave us to allow them to coach us as well. So I got conceptual coaching from Tim Keller and those guys, and then one-on-one coaching from a Canadian coach in Vancouver who was our church planting coach. So that was pretty extensive support. Yeah, now I'm a coach. My role has changed because the church is planted, and so I'm expected now to, you know, apparently after 5 years I'm supposed to know something, which is really scary, but yeah.
I was really interested in Dan's answer. What was your question again? Three categories, and
I just want to, what are some ways that you've supported the church plants under you?
Right.
And then I just kind of categorized the three church plants, but...
Yeah, I liked your categories. I never thought of them before, so those were nice.
Oh, good.
Thank you. Our life is changing as a family. I bought my mom's house, and I'm moving in there. And so we're in the process of renovating, and it's just strange to be in my parents' home and taking things apart and putting them back together again. And I'm always thinking about my dad, because my dad did things a certain way. He died 4 years ago. So it's been a lot of reminiscing. This has a point in that my dad was an entrepreneur. His father started a flower shop, and my dad took it over, and he tried all these other things, and he was the first florist to be in a mall, and malls started in Canada and all this kind of stuff. And I think growing up in that environment, in that sort of entrepreneurial world of shoestring budget and just try things and some things work and some things don't, I think that's affected me a little more than I realize. Because we've kind of stumbled along in church planting. When we planted Grace Fellowship Church, the church that I pastor, it was really because I felt an intangible call to the ministry and an equally, if not more intense, intangible call to Toronto. And there were no churches available in Toronto. So that was my profound calling to church planting, was there was nothing else to do. So we contacted Trinity Baptist in Burlington, some other churches, and said, would you give us oversight because we really want to try and plant a church in the city. And our aim was to be downtown where Dan is, and the Lord just didn't take us that way. We started with six people. Three of them were my family, four of us were family. And so we were very small. We grew in a home for 2.5 years. We were in homes. Then we moved to the school where we are now. And the Lord grew the work. And through conversions and through people, you know, just Christians coming to us from other places, people moving into the city, all that kind of stuff. We were always, right from the get-go, said we want to be a church planting church. And so that was always in our DNA. And we had targeted Julian early on, and so we brought him slowly on staff as he finished seminary. The goal was always to send him out with a group, or I would go. And for a couple of years, really, it was more I was going to go. I really still wanted to get downtown. And so the plan was I would leave, and Julian would stay back with Grace Fellowship Church, and I'd start another work downtown. And then right when we were about to do that, we got in contact kind of around the same time with Habib and John Bell. And both different situations. John was ready to plant downtown, and that just that we were doing some coaching there. But the way that was working out, that coaching turned into more into oversight. And then Habib and I were friends through a person in our church, and that relationship developed. And we started kind of just talking through his issues there, and all of a sudden we're kind of thinking we're going to be involved in planting these churches and giving oversight. So that put the brakes on sending Julian or me for another couple of years. And then once those works got up and going, and really for us, part of it is a space limitation issue. We were out of room, and that was really putting the fire under our feet to get going and sending people away. So it wasn't just that, but that helps when you just don't have anywhere to put everybody. And that led us to then target January as a launch date for Grace Fellowship Church East. And we targeted that area because we're in Markham, we're downtown with New City, and we're in the West, and so we thought, let's go East. And we had people coming from that area. We spoke to those people in our church. They were willing to go, which was a big sacrifice for a lot of people. I mean, our sheep don't change churches just willy-nilly, hopefully, right? They settle in. We have a high membership commitment. So we know our sheep, and they're very involved, and they're very much a part of our church life. And these people are saying, yeah, we're willing to leave all of that behind. The hardest one was a little, I think she's 12 years old, a little girl. Her parents said to her, you know, what's so hard about leaving? And she goes, well, I'm leaving all my friends. And, well, who are your friends? Well, Pastor Paul. Oh, I heard that. And I'm like, oh, man, like, just breaking my heart, right? And so I just pray for that little girl all the time. I just am always concerned about her. But I know the Lord's going to use that in her life, too. And her parents took her, and they went. They made that hard decision. Imagine being a dad and having to just rip your little girl out of their homeschool family. All her friends were in our church, and now they're all gone. So now she's going to make, you know, new friends. So all that to say, we want to plant churches. Entrepreneurial stuff, I think, causes me to think in terms of what's the Lord doing, what can we do. That's why I get really interested in what Dan's model, which is, I think, a lot more structured than anything we've done. And I want to learn from that because I think if we go this way too long, we'll probably destroy somebody. So,
Tim, did you have a question?
First, thanks to Dan. The trendiness of church planting. I think that's a bit of a dangerous trend in the church right now where just we seem to elevate those who are church planters and laud and honor them in strange ways. My question is along the lines of qualification in that it seems that there's not a biblical office of church planter. So we talk about it. It's a bit of a a fabricated thing or a bit of a functional thing. We have the man has to be qualified spiritually as a pastor, but then we're going to say, well, you have certain practical qualifications or largely practical qualifications that would then allow you to be a church planter. I guess I've seen a model where a man is a church planter, so he's only ever going to aim to be at a church for 5 years or something. His goal is to go in, plant, and then hand it over to somebody who's a normal pastor, a regular pastor, and he's going to go off and plant again. I wonder what you think of that model versus I'm qualified to plant, but my idea now is to stay here forever. So if you're very good at planting, shouldn't you be continually seeking to plant, build churches up, and then go plant again?
That's a really... yeah, you're hitting about...
That's a dumb question.
You're hitting about five great points, Tim. Let me riff on a few of those, because you're hitting a few of my buttons. I've had to think about this, because I'm now at a place where I've got to change from being the guy who has all the ideas and everyone just agrees with them, and they all worked spectacularly, so people thought, and now... Got an elders board, a deacons board, lay leaders, various levels. Decisions go much slower. My entrepreneurial start new stuff side has to be channeled, put aside. I've got to disempower myself and empower all kinds of other people. I've got to work through structures and systems much more. So the question is, can a guy who's entrepreneurial and likes to go by the seat of his pants and just do stuff and intuit, which was my gifting, can I change? Or should I just punt? I feel like the Lord's calling me to change. I feel like the Lord, my own personal conviction, and I'm willing to be corrected, is that a church planter is a church planting pastor who should grow his church and learn to be a shepherd. It's part of his sanctification to learn, to humble himself, stopping the big kahuna, give it over to plurality of elders, give it over to systems and processes, and learn to pastor like everybody else. There's a weird sort of rock star quality of being a church planner that you need to get over, in both in terms of doing it and feeling the freedom to do it your way. And you need to humble yourself and learn to serve. And that's the process I've gone through. It's been one of the best processes of sanctification. I don't like the model of a church planner giving it off over 5 years to someone else and then going to plant another church. It feels to me like they get stuck in a kind of a spiritual adolescence, especially today where church planting is such a rock star thing. So
can I interject there? So what about the guy who would counter then and say, well, that's just what the Apostle Paul did. You know, he's in Ephesus for a couple of years.
Yeah,
he's here for...
That's the other side that I need to say is the Apostle Paul kind of did that, but that was an apostolic calling. And so I'm trying to figure out, you know, the office of apostle is gone. There are some of those gifts that may still be around. So I think there may be people like that, but I sure don't want to elevate that as the model. I think most church planners, for their own sanctification, and I might be wrong, so I'm willing to be corrected on this, but I know for my own, so I'm extrapolating from my experience. For me, it's been very humbling and very sanctifying to learn to submit myself now to elders who say slow it down, to lay people that don't understand why we're slowing it down, because I'm now under the authority of my elders and they said slow this part down and the lay people are mad at me. I had two major reconciliation meetings this past month with lay people who said, you promised this and it's taken this long and it's still not here, and I had to go and say, well, the elders told me I had to wait a year because we had all these other things, including the move. And so I'm caught between elders telling me to slow it down and lay people not understanding, and it's been very humbling for me, very good for me. So for me, a church if you're called to the pastor, you're called to shepherd, and a church planner only stays 5 years and leaves, I don't know that in 5 years you really get into shepherding issues. For me, it's in the fifth year that all the shepherding issues and trust came out. I know more junk about my people, and I've known them for 5 years. I didn't know the junk for the first four. Now the trust level is, now I'm finding out, now I've married them, now they're, you know, so now I'm in the junk. The stuff that the easiest thing for me to do right now would be to walk away and go plant another church and just start new and all the vision and all that, and you don't get into the nitty gritty. So I feel like a pastor, and you can talk about this, I don't know, but it's about the fifth year for me that the real shepherding stuff came out, and now I have to learn to be a shepherd and not just a rock star leader. So it's been very, very good for me. Now, I think you're right, there are some people. But I know for me in my own life, that would have been a spiritual, stunting, adolescent move just to move on. So I've had to kind of hear the Lord say to me, it's time for you to grow up and feel what every other pastor feels like. Oh, it's easy to talk vision, but now when you've got 30 broken marriages or sexual issues or porn or whatever that you're dealing with, you don't have time to go preach vision all the time. You got to get in there and you got to spend your nights crying with people and weeping with people and going to the hospitals. And, you know, 3 years ago, I probably wouldn't have understood how a regular pastor struggles to keep vision in front. Now in my sixth year, I completely understand why a senior pastor can lose his vision in the urgency of the shepherding that's in front of them. And so I feel like as a church planter, I'm starting to grow up. So I don't know if that helps answer your question, but those are great questions. You had a couple others too, but I've forgotten them now.
Habib, what do you think about that? Are you planning to take off soon from Grace Chapel?
As long as they have me there, I'll stay. But I totally agree. It changes you fundamentally as you do this. I mean, you think you're in this ministry of church planting to effect certain change in a certain place with certain group of people. But in the process, you know, you are being transformed and conformed to the image of Christ, and you discover things about yourself that are pretty ugly. And you need to really, you know, issues of pride and selfishness, and you know, you start where, you know, with doing things with flexibility and freedom, no membership, and you get certain things done your way, and yeah, then you'd have to face, you know, all of these issues as they arise later on, with having to come before the members and having to have, you know, come and have a real active plurality of elders, and yeah, it really teaches you a lot about yourself, and in my particular case as well is, in an incredible way, it really got us closer as a family, myself, my wife, and my daughter. And it's just through this, we have come to really look at this and look at ourselves and say, you know, we can't take this for granted. This is way too precious, and just to see the grace of God at work in my family as well through this, and the changes that God is doing is tremendous. So I think it is a good thing to stick through it and to learn to shepherd the flock and be there as long as the Lord has you there. And as far as the model in Acts, I think it is more of descriptive, I think, rather than prescriptive. That's personally my opinion.
Yeah, brother. We'll run you a mic there.
Thank you, Dan and Habib, for giving that pastoral side and talking about the importance of shepherding the flock as well. You know, it's a good balance with the church planning. And yet, you know, both of you had moved up. How do you know when it's time to move on when shepherding the current flock you're with? Because some of us are, you know, like myself, I'm a new pastor, just 3 years at a church, and they've taken me on for another 3-year term. And how do you know when it's time to move on? Why did you move on? Is it a level of rejection? Is it a doctrinal difference? Where does patience come in? You know, I often feel, this past week, a couple of things have happened, and I felt quite frustrated with some of the members. And does that mean I should move on, or is it something that I, is it an opportunity for sanctification? You know, how do you balance those?
If the Holy Spirit's in the room, he can answer that question, I think, better. Paul, you're the closest to the Holy Spirit that I know. Maybe you can answer that question.
I'll quote one who is closer to the Holy Spirit. John MacArthur once said to us, that he had made a determination never to leave when things were hard. He would only leave Christ Community Church when it was good. And then what happens is, when things are good, you never want to leave. So he's been there for 40 years, I think, almost now, right? And I don't know, that always stuck with me. I left the church after 2.5 years, my first church, because I told them I was only there for a short time. I wanted to be in Toronto. It was up north. Second church, I intended to stay there for my life, but then we just came to different doctrinal conclusions on an issue of eschatology, and so it just to be in that denomination, you had to sign off. I couldn't sign off. So it made it very simple. But I don't know. I just you can't say anything carte blanche. It's not the Bible. But that little thought has always been a help to me. I don't want to leave anywhere when it's bad. I want to see it through, believing the gospel is going to bring about the reconciliation and change that is necessary. And then when things are good, maybe that's the time to think about moving on. But when things are good, who wants to leave?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think really hard for me to answer that for you. I left another place because I was an associate pastor. The senior pastor coming out of seminary said, I know you're called to plant churches. We will keep you for 3 to 5, and then we will help send you. And that's what they did. And then at the third year, it was becoming obvious that I was ready to leave, and they were at a place where they were ready to send. And the timing came to be. They sent me out on searches in Canada and Australia. The elders sent me out to 2 places to look at church planting. We had connections in Toronto and in Melbourne, Australia. Narrowed it down to those 2. And then in a process of discernment, they sent me to an assessment center. The assessment center came back and said, you know, qualified to church plant, presently discouraged by a lack of ability to have a child. There's a little bit of an emotional tendency toward melancholy in him. My assessment said if he's to be sent out, he can be sent out as a parachute, but needs encouragement from the church that sends him out. And so the elders of the church in Florida said, we're not sending you to Australia. It's too hard to support you emotionally. We're going to send you to Toronto. Let's find a place in Toronto. And so that's when we negotiated with Grace Toronto about coming here to renew the work. It was a combination of my weaknesses, my strengths, my callings. But I would say, thinking about Grace Toronto, people keep asking me, you know, because Steve Beck left Grace Toronto after 9 or 10 years, and kind of a lot of people felt cut off at the knees. They're like, so what about you? When are you leaving? So I told them, I'm leaving when you kick me out, firstly. Or when we all feel it's time for me to leave. And as far as I can tell, the way to answer that question is when Grace Toronto would be better served by me leaving, and I would be better served by me leaving, when both of us would be better served by me leaving, it's time for me to leave. There's a church planter I know in a different part of Canada whose elder board made that commitment for their church to move to the next level and for him to move to the next level. It was a yes in both ways, for the church and for him to leave now or in the next year or so. And I think that was a helpful way to analyze it.
13 years, patience really to try and see things change. And I think one of the key elements for me in my case was realizing the devastating effect of a lack of solidarity in the leadership, whether it be the pastoral team or the board of elders, and their fundamental doctrinal differences. And so over the years waiting, you know, we were in an interim mode, and you know, the church was looking for a senior pastor, and so there's always this hope that when he comes, he will hopefully, you know, hope will be on the way. But when that took place, and it was quite unfortunately disappointing, and I came to realize that this isn't changing. And you know, added to that, 13 years and people that there was also this sense of overwhelming responsibility to the people that are you know, have been entrusted to me. I felt that, you know, they really truly were convicted about practicing and living the full counsel of God, whether it be baptism or the doctrines of grace, and we couldn't do that in that context without having to confront the elders and the leaders, and which would bring more division in the church. And so it was with great reluctancy that felt that we need to move on. And one more thing, I would say this with great caution. You know, when your conscience as well, you come to the place where your conscience, you know, brings conviction to bear upon you, you know, sanctified by Scripture, with godly counsel around you, then, you know, you don't want to act hastily, but you need to be able to lay your head on the pillow and make sure that you are okay with the Lord. So,
I want you guys to answer this question. How do you How do you know when a church plant has failed and it's time to pull the plug? You can wrestle over the mic.
Well, I don't know if it's an answer, but I know it sounds like I'm repeating myself, but I really, really think, and see more than ever the value of having that oversight, the plurality of elders, watching over the work and over you as a church planter, and I think together, this is something that happens in that context where they will speak into your life and evaluate prayerfully the work that is taking place and then a decision will be made at that time. I can't highlight the importance of that enough.
There's like 100 questions that I'd want to answer before I answer that. So, I'll try and just answer the question. How do you know a church plant has failed and it's time to pack up? A church plant needs to have gotten to a certain point before it's considered a success. It needs to reach. If it doesn't reach that point and has stopped progressing toward that point, it's time.
What's the point?
So
I'll go ahead and ask the question that you're wanting me to ask you.
A successful church plant, in my mind, needs to be missionally effective, evangelistically effective. But missional means too many things to too many people. It needs to be seeing. Now, this is Canada, and it's a very difficult spiritual climate, but you need to be seeing conversions, at least 6 to 10 a year at minimum. So evangelistically effective, it needs to be growing in depth and in numbers, and it needs to be financially self-sufficient with its own governance, whatever your governance is. Elders is mine. So for us, assuming doctrinal fidelity, so we have our Westminster standards, but assuming a church needs to be moving towards being able to financially sustain itself. It has its own elders and deacons board, and it's seeing conversions and people growing in depth of understanding of the gospel. And if it doesn't get there and it's stopped somewhere prior to there and isn't moving forward after a prolonged period, it's obvious it's, we sent out a church in Vancouver with 50 people, and after 4 years, it had 38. Still not financially self-sustaining. Didn't have its own elder board. We had to tell them we had to pull the plug after 4 years. They were shocked, appalled. How could you do this? You start with 50 and you end with 40 in 4 years, and you still aren't self-sustaining. There hasn't been a conversion in two. It's just kind of, to me, it's you're there. You have to look in the mirror and go. We never became our own independent governing body that could pay our own bills. Like, those are pretty obvious to me, so not to him, but it's okay.
Keith.
Dan, you mentioned the tools of assessment obviously available through the PCA for Habib and Paul. What other tools for, say, seminary students or pastors who are considering church planting, what are available? I assume there must be some others that would be within a reform context where candidates could at least have some assessment. Obviously, the denomination, SGF's not large enough to have that as a whole, but can you recommend other resources where one suitability could be tested?
I should just mention one that's outside of our denomination. Our denomination, together with a bunch of denominations, including John Neufeld's group at Willingdon and Mission BC, and some others, are pulling together a church planning coalition right now, and we're going to do 3 assessments that are not denominationally specific, one for Central Canada, one for the Prairies, and then one for Western Canada this year. So I'm not sure even what they're going to call this group, but the agreement is 6 days old, but we've met with a coalition of people, including Vision 360 and the Church Planning BC guys of Neufeld and some others, and we're putting together a national coalition to have these assessments available, and they're going to use our methodology and our stuff for now, and then we'll probably contextualize it to something slightly refined, but that's one thing that's about to be available. Yes.
Is there an expense? Is that a?
It's not free.
No, I understand. Can you give an idea of the cost that might be incurred with that?
Yeah. So we've run these assessments now, for at least for the 5-6 years that I've been around, and they've generally been about $1,000 per person, just about $1,800 per couple. That's fairly subsidized, by the way. We probably subsidize that half. If you do it in the States, I think it's double the cost in American funds. Okay, so 80% double. They're going the wrong way. But, yeah, it's significant because of all the testing and all the administering of the 360-degree leadership test. You have two people above you, two peers, and two people below you that assess you in, I think, 300-plus questions about your character, your knowledge of Scripture, your ability to preach, all of these things. Plus the 5 days of it, you know, the assessors give up 5 days of their life and they work 7 to 12. So usually their bills are paid by the candidates. So it's a big deal to be assessed the way we do it. But yeah.
May I ask the question, or I'm going to be fined?
No, you can.
All right. About the assessment, I mean, how do you keep the balance between, you know, going through an assessment and then the relational aspect of actually people who really know you, right? I mean, you're spending, what, 5 days or a weekend with people that they practically know nothing about you.
One of the rules of assessments is we cannot assess people outside of what the people who really know them have already told us in the references. So the 300 questions and the 6 people who really know you as a candidate, that forms the trajectory of what we can say. We cannot, in the 4 or 5 days, if we see something that's outside of those things, we cannot assess you. Say all of a sudden we see an impatience that never came up, some kind of irritability that never came up. We just discard that as a one-off because the references really are the people who know you, and there's a trajectory there of deep investment. Unless we see a repeated irritability or something strange, then we might mention it. If several assessors over several days saw a pattern that had never showed up, we will ask them about it, but it never gets in the report usually because it's the people who know you, and it's that 360-degree assessment before you get there that forms our preliminary snapshot of you, and there needs to be a tsunami of change between what it says and what we see before we depart in any way from the general trajectory, actually the fairly specific trajectory of what it says. We weight what they say more than what we notice. But it's unbelievable in the assessing process how they almost always completely come together. Those 6 people usually know you so well that they've told us what to look for, and we usually see it completely confirmed. Yeah.
Yeah, brothers.
I'd like to get back to the point when is a church plant successful, and then also considering what should be done either beforehand or after a church plant is unsuccessful. We talked about assessing the church planter, but I know 2 young families who were sent to a pretty hard area of Canada as church planters, and after 3 years they have given up and they've gone. And in fact, a couple of the families of believers in the area with whom they were working have also given up and left that region of Canada. So how do you prepare the ground for church planting, and how do you make an assessment as to whether you're actually sending a missionary or a church planter, and then how do you gauge success looking at it from those 2 different perspectives, a missionary or a church planter?
We don't make the distinction. Every church planter is a missionary. But your story highlights for us the follies of our past and the reason we are so cautious about assessing people. Too many of those stories litter the past history of the PCA's church planting attempts. Therefore, we have made our assessment much more rigorous so that we, and Acts 29 has come to us, and by the way, it said our assessment was way too unrigorous and we have too many casualties. We need to learn to be more thorough. And the reason for that is we just don't like the damage that happens. That this couple could be burnt out for years, this potentially wonderful church planting couple. So we assess the man or the couple. That's the first thing. They need to have the character and the competence to be a church planter. If they can't preach, if they can't lead, if they can't evangelize, and if they can't gather people with some level of envisioning ability, they're probably not called to be a church planter. And if they don't have the character to deal with all of the, those of you who are church planners, you know how hard it is. Those of you who are solo pastors, you know, I mean, every idol gets exposed. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, how do you decide whether a place is a fertile place to plant churches? We, in the, at least the way we think fairly urban, generally speaking, because that's the area of greatest need and the area of greatest population. So like Paul did, he just first started planning at the biggest, most strategic cities. We kind of think that way about Canada. The cities have been underserved, the suburbs have been overserved, and the rural somewhere in between. I think in Canada, the suburbs are the probably the most churched, still way unchurched, by the way. We need tons of suburban churches. Cities, least churched. And at least in places like Toronto and Vancouver, a massive young professional generation is rising up in those places with no one to serve them. And so we start with the cities, and we just don't have enough church planners to even to go much elsewhere. So where do you go? Where it's strategic, where it's needed. Or our second thing is where there's an appropriate core group calling them. So if it's rural or suburban, we then examine what's the fertility of this group. Is this group really aligned philosophically, doctrinally? There's three stools. I was talking to Ian about Vaillancourt, I don't know how you pronounce that, Ontario. I grew up in Quebec. I was talking to Ian about this, that there's really a three-legged stool that needs to be a match between the leader and his people. There needs to be a doctrinal alignment. There needs to be a philosophy of ministry alignment, and there needs to be a leadership style alignment between leader and core group or congregation. They have to be willing to deal with you doctrinally. Ian had that agreement. But the other two legs, he said, just weren't there. His philosophy of ministry was not working. There needs to be an alignment on philosophy of ministry and your leadership style. Like, if you're fairly entrepreneurial, your elders need to give you room to do that, or there's going to be such a fight. And so I think we look for those kind of connections. Is there an alignment with this group philosophically? Is there an alignment with this group and their church planter or leader, you know, leadership style and doctrinally? If you've got those three, there's a good chance that there's a match. Does that help?
Maybe I could just throw, this would relate to both questions, what you had asked as well. Keith, Acts 29 references another good one. I would just throw way up on that list as well. If I knew a young man in seminary who was interested in church planting, I would say, get yourself in a church plant now. And you will never get better experience than being in a church plant and walking along. Just help. I think you gain the opportunity to do so many things you'll never do in an established bigger church, because there's so much to be done. And so, you know, when those young guys come around me, I'm like, great, let's get you going. And, you know, make an agreement with that pastor. And if you're a young man, I think you need to chase him sometimes, because we get busy. And you need to say, hey, you promised you're going to spend time with me and you're going to invest in my life. Let's have it, you know. So I think that's a great thing to put at the top of the list. If you're truly interested in church planting and you're in that stage in life where you can make some of those choices to put yourself around church planters and learn and learn and learn all you can. And then I thought there was something else, but I don't remember. Julian.
Can you guys tease out for us a little bit, just thinking about the church plants that you did, where Habib and Paul, you're kind of looking from, I'm going to plant a church. I need some body of elders to help oversee, whereas Dan, you're coming out of more of a context where you're already coming from established church and association of churches, well, denomination really, that's where there's structures in place for sending. I'm wondering, even in your context, Dan, though, you're getting sent from Florida to plant in Toronto, where I'm wondering, what's the role more locally or even association-wide? Is there room for you guys to work together on these things, even where there's doctrinal differences, not you guys, but I mean just churches in general? What's the role of associations, fellowships of churches, those types of things? Or is it all specifically local church or denomination-based?
My vision is for a local Toronto church planting network that is reformed and missional to grow. I shared this vision with a couple of guys, and we're actually there's a group of pastors talking and thinking and praying about something like that right now, because I think we have different competencies sometimes, and I think you can share the wealth. I think, like, for example, in Toronto, if we created a network, someone might be good at coaching, someone might, in certain areas, some might be better at coaching preaching, someone might be good at coaching mentoring, and so a church planter, if there was a right mix here in Toronto, like a church planting center, Paul, we could really do something. So if, for example, you know, TBS would be willing to help be part of the theological thing, and Paul would be helping be part of the mentoring and establishing things in Grace Toronto and then maybe some other churches, you know, we could really cook. Just a thought. So I really think there's a role. As a matter of fact, it's a vision that a couple of us share to have something like that, to have a real church planting center where people can get real effective training and coaching and oversight.
We have time for one last question here.
I'm not really a church planter in a way, just a tent maker. The International Baptist Church, so which is the under fellowship of Evangelical Baptist Churches, and we're just adopted as a church planting ministry. And my question as well is just that now I'm in the sixth year, and I'm just wondering as well, I want really to go on, but then the church has not yet been developed in a way, still in a process of, we have now just get independent last year as a church now, and some leaders as well, but we are in a way in regards to financially. So is it wise I just have to get this the church to stand in their own and then move on? Because that's what I'm, maybe two more years or something. And there's one thing as well that, as you have mentioned in regards to a church planter, that is it you have to stay or move on? Because I have one as well down in Cambridge and some 3 years ago, and they have called just to help out in the ministry, and just only a Bible studies, and then Temple Baptist Church help us out, and as well, and the in having that Sunday school as well, as every Sunday I go there in the morning. And now, after a year, I have given that to the pastor that was there as well. So now they are a church. But I'm still with this in Mississauga, in Streetsville, as a sixth year. And we are now, please, like.
You know, your context, the complexity of your situation sort of reminds me, I won't be able to answer the specifics of your situation without more ask and answer. What you would need, in my opinion, is a coach, because you have a lot of very good questions and a lot of very complicated situations where a good church planting coach can help you sort through when to do this and when to do that, et cetera. You remind me of the kind of questions I was asking for 5 years, my church planting coach. When do I do this, and when do I do that, and when do I do that? Because every church planting context is different. For example, I had picketers for over a year at my church, and there was nothing in my church planting course in seminary that said how to deal with picketers.
There's a tab at the back of the manual.
Right.
To do
when picket- you know, Stephen Beck, when in the first Grace Toronto, when they moved out of their space, gave the grand piano to someone to keep for a while until Grace Toronto could get back on its feet. They walked away with the piano. They refused to answer our calls. I didn't know. You know, those kind of things, there's just nothing in the manuals for. And you're in a situation where you have very specific questions. They're not in the manuals. And I think you could really use a church planting coach to help you sort through some of these things, because they're very specific to you. You're in a very unique situation. So I would recommend to you to find a coach that can help you sort through these really good, sticky questions that you're facing at this point in your ministry as to who you are and where the church is and what
you spoke already to one at the end of fellowship with the, I guess, the church planting director there or something. And I haven't get back to him yet because they want us to be part of the church planting ministry as well. And I guess I have to file. It's still in the process that if it's that one or which one, or, you know. So, Thank you.
Habib, my question, just to kind of close us out here, you've got 2 or 3 minutes with a fellow that's just about to plant. That's all the time you get. What do you want to tell him? That's all you're going to say? Are you sure?
I'll try to discourage him. Do 3 minutes. Read the book of Acts, memorize it, 1st, 2nd Timothy and Titus. And place yourself under, you know, oversight of godly men who will walk you through the process and stay close. Stay accountable.
What would you add?
I thought that was brilliant. Are you sure? I don't know what to add. 3 minutes. I would look a person in the eye and I would say, because you're planning a church as the founder, you have no one else to blame. So there are very different pressures on you. You've got nowhere to blame shift to if this thing fails. So if you have an idol of success or failure, it will come out. Church planting is the greatest idol revealing exercise I have ever experienced. It can crush you. Church planting in a spiritually indifferent place like Canada, in a spiritually indifferent city, maybe hostile city like Toronto, is far and away the toughest thing I have ever experienced. I'm sure there are tougher things. Being a missionary to a Muslim country, I think, must be tougher. But for my weak, cowardly life, this is the hardest thing, most idle illustrating thing. You had better have the gospel deep into your soul. Jesus has to be enough for you. And you have to be willing to die. I had to die to all my idols just to start the church. And then the church succeeded, quote unquote. And then I had to die to the kind of pastor I was and learn to be a new kind of pastor for a new season of the church. Learn to be a shepherd, a long-term guy, not a startup guy. So I've had to die to myself time after time after time in ways I never thought I would have to die. And so I'm tired, to be honest with you. I'm dying to myself. But I would look a person in the eye and say that. Are you willing to die and do whatever it takes and be whoever God calls you to be to make this church a vibrant, successful church? Are you willing to die because you have to?
Great. I think this is the right time, right? I always forget what time we're supposed to end. So I look to Julian, who knows everything. And he nods. Thank you, Habib. Thank you, Dan. There's going to be some coffee out those doors and some other stuff to eat, so you're very welcome to do that. I think these guys have a little time to stick around as well, so if you have questions that you wanted to ask and were not able to, they would be thrilled to talk to you about that. So why don't we stand, and I'll close our time in a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for the freedom to sit around and talk about planting churches, both the political freedom, but also the spiritual freedom, that these things are even on our radar, is a gift from your grace. And so we give you praise for that. And we pray that you would have encouraged us in some way today and taught us in some way. I know my heart has been very challenged and excited and rebuked, all those things, and I give you the thanks and the praise for that. Lord, please be in our city. Raise churches up in our city. We could plant churches on nearly every block, and we would not have yet touched the population of this city. So please put to death all the pride in us, all the ungodly fear in us, and use us, Lord, however you see fit to advance the gospel here. We pray in the name of Christ. Amen.